Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. Eighteenth century British historian Horace Walpole famously said, "The volley fired by a young Virginian in the backwoods of America set the world on fire." That young Virginian was Colonel George Washington, and those backwoods were the vast and controversial territory known as the Ohio Country. On this episode of Wartime, we discuss the Battle of Fort Necessity and how it changed British North America forever. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. In Season 1 of the series, we're discussing North America's colonial frontier, the people and ideas that defined it, and the events and places that changed its future forever. In today's episode, we're discussing the Battle of Fort Necessity, much more than just a singular event in the forest, but a defining benchmark and high water mark for the end of a way of life in North America's frontier. In the last episode, we discussed George Washington's earliest experiences in the Ohio Country and, as it turns out, his earliest experiences in the military. On today's episode, however, we'll be focusing on the aftermath of those events, the greater meaning behind them, and how they affected our world as we know it. In 1754, North America was in the midst of a radical change. It was a continent of not two empires, but three. The French Empire dominated Canada, the British Empire dominated the east coast of North America, and the vaunted Iroquois Confederacy dominated the American frontier. Now, in 1753, we saw a 21-year-old George Washington march on his French adversaries in western Pennsylvania. His mission was to politely ask them to vacate the disputed area of the Ohio Country. Even more than just the importance of this event to George Washington was what he represented, because he was acting on behalf of the colony of Virginia. In turn, that colony was acting on behalf of British North America and, of course, the British Empire as a whole. But the events of 1754 are much more telling and much more dramatic, as we'll see. George Washington is a character in this drama, but he's not the only character, although oftentimes the story focuses around him to make the whole circumstance more understandable. We'll explore all those issues today. But in 1754, things were heating up in what was previously a Cold War. The Ohio Country, which is today western Pennsylvania in the state of Ohio, was long claimed by both the British and French at this time. But only in the previous year had the French begun to make more open and outward claims of the region. Those claims came in the form of four fortifications built in the wilderness. South of Lake Erie, they built Fort Presque Isle. 15 miles south of that was Fort Leboeuf. Farther south of that, at the region's premier Indian village, was Fort Venango, sometimes called Fort Michaux. And most importantly south of that was the most strategically important fort of the Ohio Country. It was the small, unassuming, yet meaningful fortress of Fort Duquesne. Now, why Fort Duquesne was so important was interesting, because it extended into a larger imperial policy of France, which was to explore all waterways of North America and exploit them for their own means. What they built was something of a circulatory system, connecting all of the colonies and all of the reaches of the empire, which was very much an economic empire based on trade, with the heartland of New France along the St. Lawrence River. We'll talk more about Fort Duquesne in a little bit. But in 1753, George Washington, on the request of the Lieutenant Governor of Virginia, made his expedition into the Ohio Country, and it was largely a failure. He did complete his strategic objective, which was to ask the French politely to leave, but of course the foregone conclusion was that they wouldn't do so. On his journey back to Virginia, dejected, Washington nearly dies twice, from his own blundering inexperience. But after he returns, again, the foregone conclusion was made. The Empire of New France was not going anywhere, and it would be on Virginia to retaliate in the name of her king. What we see now is a bit of empire rearing its ugly head once again. George Washington is given a promotion. He becomes Lieutenant Colonel Washington, and he is promptly given a new mission. And his mission is to march back into the hellish cold of the Ohio country and begin the makings of a fortification. Now, what Washington doesn't know in 1754 when he receives this very surprising assignment, considering the relatively poor nature of his first mission, is that the colony of Virginia has already begun to fortify the Ohio country before he even returned. Again, the conclusion of Washington's 1753 mission was foregone. The French weren't going anywhere. Under the command of a man named William Trent, the colony of Virginia sent he with a group of supplies and men into the wilds of the Ohio country to establish a fortification in the name of Britain at the point where three rivers come together. Those are the Monongahela, flowing south to north out of today's West Virginia, the Allegheny River, flowing north to south out of today's New York State, forming the Ohio River, which is, again, your direct superhighway to the Mississippi River and your key to the continent. Now, these men and their tiny expedition would build a tiny fort, or at least the makings of a tiny fort, and they would build it at the place called the Forks of the Ohio. This is modern Pittsburgh. The fort they built would come to be known as Fort Prince George, named after King George's young son. Incidentally, that is the George III of the American Revolution that we'll come to despise so much in American popular culture. But the fort began in its construction, and while it's meager, Trent and Ward, the ensign who joined him, knew that its mere presence was enough to be successful. Now, it's very hard to understand the 18th century world of colonial America without understanding the larger Indian world. And that's something we'll discuss in detail now, because it's highly important to really making the entire time period click. All too often in history, and we'll see this illustrated many times in this episode, we'll look at events that seem coincidental or fortuitous, and we'll write them off to good luck. Well, remember, in history, there are no coincidences. And if you can't find an answer, it's not because there isn't one. It's usually because you're not looking in the right way or the right place. With the completion of Fort Prince George, what the Empire of Great Britain essentially did was created at the most vital geographic crossroads of the American frontier a stable and hopefully long-lasting British presence. Now, why is that important? Well, again, we like to say that North America is a land of three empires: the British on the East Coast, the French in Canada, and the Iroquois Confederacy in what is today New York State and along the American frontier in the Northeast. Now, the Iroquois Confederacy is a collection of six different tribes. Moving west to east, they are the Seneca, the Cayuga, the Onondaga, the Oneida, the Tuscarora, and the Mohawk. Now, as an imperial historian, we have a real aversion to describing things that we have a personal connection to or a personal amount of pride to as an empire. But as I always say, if it looks like a duck and it sounds like a duck, it's probably an empire. The Iroquois Confederacy operates in many ways as any empire would. They've got a power structure, they've got an agreement in principle, and like all empires, they also have subjects. Now, their subjects are the subaltern classes in Native America. They are the Delaware, who have been pushed out of their home in the Delaware River Valley of Pennsylvania, New Jersey. They are the Shawnee, whose name literally translates to wanderers, a constant refugee people, but a proud people nonetheless. And their original Iroquois migrants to the region of the Ohio country we call the Mingo. You see, in the 1640s, the Iroquois Confederacy cleansed the Ohio country of its people. We call these the Beaver Wars. It was an inter-native conflict brought on by European pressures. But as a way of really establishing their control over the Ohio country, the Iroquois Confederacy did what many empires do. They allowed these refugee peoples to settle the region, of course the Delaware and the Shawnee, as long as they gave homage to them, and they colonized the region as any empire would. Now, most of these colonists came from the Seneca and Cayuga tribes, and after two or three or four generations, these colonists became known as something different. They became known as Mingo. So the Ohio country was the support base for the Iroquois Confederacy. It was the home to their subjects. Well, as the British and French begin to conflict more often, more frequently, and more hotly, it became very clear that the Iroquois Confederacy, which was a British ally, was going to be on the side of Great Britain. It's a very big topic we'll make very simple. For the French, however, in desperate need of a native ally in the region, it was these subjects of the Iroquois that became their support base. The idea was very simple. They cared nothing for the fate of New France, but if Britain won, the Iroquois would remain their imperial masters. If New France won, with their help, the Iroquois would be defeated. So there was clearly something in it for the three groups of people, Shawnee, Delaware, and Mingo, we call the Ohioans. This will set the stage for the French and Indian War, and will bring us to the importance of the small Fort Prince George we've described that was built by the English in 1754. If the British maintained a strong, resolute, clear presence in the Ohio country, it was a message to the Ohioans, who were still admittedly wavering between the French and the British, that they could be the ones to support them. And joining the French would be a bad move, not only militarily, but economically as well. Fort Prince George would be the new base of trade. Well, the young Washington is unaware of this fort initially, but when he discovers its somewhat completion, at least we can say its founding, he's very excited, because he knows what this means. Britain has a leg up on the French, who are building forts to their north in the Ohio country. The key to the region, therefore the key to the continent in many ways, is who controls the forks of the Ohio. King George has the edge. Well, that's an edge that won't last long, because as George Washington is given his mission back in Virginia, which is to support and supply the new Fort Prince George, something quite dramatic happens, which reveals one of the great weaknesses of the British position in 1754. Remember we mentioned that New France was something of a circulatory system, connecting everything using North American waterways back to its central hub of Quebec. Well, in that simple system, waterways as connectivity, the French effectively built an early lead in what would be known as the Great War for Empire. They had something Britain didn't, which was accessibility. Now, for accessibility, they sacrificed permanence, because such a easy and delicate balance, such as constructing forts on waterways, was something that could be severed very easily, and effectively cutting off the other forts altogether. But this early in the game, it was their strength. And because they had built Fort Presque Isle and Fort Lebeuf and Fort Venango or Fort Michaud to the north, they had easy access to a very tenuous British position. As the British had been fortifying the position, the French flotilla out of the north, with several hundred men and native allies, quickly descended on the small, meager Fort Prince George and commandeered the position for New France. Now, interestingly enough, the fort was going to fall. I mean, there was no way that the small British contingent at the forks of the Ohio could defend it. They were not alone. If you remember back to Washington's 1753 mission, the half-king, Tanach Harrison, the highest-ranking Indian diplomat of the region, was actually with the British at the small Fort Prince George. And he was the first one to shout out to deny to the French. He shouted something along the lines of, "I have laid the first brick of this fort, and I will defend it. To challenge it is to insult me and the larger Iroquois Confederacy." So clearly we see something at play here. Again, Tanacharison is one of the only people in the Iroquois Old Guard to see the Ohioans drifting toward the French. And he's doing anything he can, and it will be a futile effort, to stop the Ohioans from rebelling against the larger Iroquois Confederacy, and therefore stop them from joining the armies of New France in as military allies. Well, the small British position will be taken, and the French will begin construction of what they will call Fort Duquesne. Now, Fort Duquesne is named after the highest-ranking administrator of New France, and it is not a fort that is permanent in any way, shape, or form. But, like its English counterpart they had just captured, it didn't need to be. Fort Duquesne could be abandoned at any time. It was connected to the larger network of waterways of the New World. But its position in the Ohio country gave France a distinct advantage in what was becoming the Great War for Empire. Native peoples, mostly Delaware, mostly Shawnee, mostly Mingo, would go there to trade. They'd be supplied with weapons, supplies, alcohol, tools, you name it. And it would become the center of activity in the entire region. Remember, the Ohioans were the people the French needed to win over, and the presence of Fort Duquesne would aid in doing just that. So what we have, in essence, is a dramatic shift in the Ohio country. And the politics of the region are set to change in a very different and extraordinarily violent, in some cases, way. Let's get back to George Washington. He's been the focal point of a lot of this lecture. And again, it is generally because of our familiarity with him, but also because of the role that he plays in the larger outcome of the conflict. He is now further south, and last time we left him, he was leaving the state of Virginia, the colony of Virginia at that time, with the intention of reinforcing Fort Prince George. Now, obviously, with Fort Prince George being taken, and Fort Duquesne being began in construction, he is now out of the loop. And as he's getting to a place called Will's Creek, which is Christopher Gist, his former guide's plantation in the Ohio country, it's very much an oasis of safety in the Ohio country for anyone of the English world. He is met by Ensign Ward, Ensign Ward being one of the men forced out of the Forks of the Ohio by the French incursion to build Fort Duquesne. And while they're there and while they're talking, Washington and Ward are beginning to align themselves on the same page. Washington had no idea that Fort Prince George was ever taken, and Ward had no idea Washington was coming. Clearly, for Washington at this point, even in his levels of inexperience, he understands that the game has changed. He knows that his mission is no longer to reinforce a British fort at the Forks of the Ohio, but it's now potentially to assault a French position in the same place. Washington knew how important the Forks of the Ohio were. He wrote of it in his journal in 1753, an event we covered in Season 1, Episode 1 of Wartime. And he understands that now things will have to be altered, and there's much more at stake than just his livelihood or his reputation. Both of those will be increased dramatically if he's successful. But he writes a letter back to Governor Dinwiddie of Virginia and alerts him to the situation. And Dinwiddie will provide, in turn, support. An assault on Fort Duquesne is essential. Washington is now a lieutenant colonel. Why not have him lead the assault? Dinwiddie will send to Washington about 150 to 200 North and South Carolinians, New Yorkers, and Marylanders. Again, Washington is in command of Virginia militia. And they are given the green light to assault Fort Duquesne. Now, it's never that easy. And the native peoples will play a profound role in this. At this point, the half-king, Tanacharison, the man who marched with Washington in 1753 and tried unsuccessfully to hold off the French at Fort Duquesne, in 1754, just a few weeks earlier, will arrive at Wills Creek and begin talking with Washington about his potential for success. Now, Tanich Harrison knows Washington is not an ideal man to lead this expedition. He knows he's inexperienced, and he knows that there's probably better men available. But he also knows that there's a sense of urgency here. Remember, Tanich Harrison is not in this to keep the Iroquois and British relationship alive. He's not even in it to see Britain be successful. Tanich Harrison is in this to maintain his own Iroquois way of life. What the immediate threat to that is, are the subjects of the Iroquois, the Ohioans, potentially rebelling against them by joining the French in alliance in their war for empire against Britain. Washington's his man, and any intelligence that Tanich Harrison has is going to be essential for their success. And what Tanich Harrison is able to tell Washington is that there is actually word that a French diplomatic party, less than 150 people, maybe even less than 100 people, has marched south out of Fort Duquesne toward the colony of Virginia, toward Washington's position. Now, Washington's excited to hear this, but he's also anxious. He knows that he needs to confront the French. There's no doubt about that. But he doesn't know how. He's never engaged a French enemy on the field of battle, leading men in his life. Remember, he's a lieutenant colonel. And by the end of this, he's going to get another promotion, even though he's done almost nothing to deserve it. Now, what's the word? Well, what Tanich Harrison tells Washington is that this party, again, is moving south ahead of them. And it's very likely that they are camped in a ravine in the forest less than a day's march away. Washington and his men will follow Tanich Harrison's word. Tanich Harrison will bring some warriors with him as well. And what they find is that the Half-King was absolutely right. In the middle of a dark forest, before sunrise, Washington, his partners, the men he's leading, the Indians with him, find the French party camped in a ravine, surrounded on both sides by high ground, completely unaware that anyone is nearby. And this is the quintessential sitting duck for Washington. The onus is now on him to make a decision. And the question is, what's it going to be? Well, the result is nothing short of disaster. At about daybreak, we don't know who fires first, but both parties, the French in this deep ravine, the English and natives all around them, spot each other. There's a firefight. It's a muted firefight, but there is some significant exchange. Now, this is a worst-case scenario for Washington, because what the French are yelling during the smoke and the chaos of 18th century warfare is that we are a diplomatic party, and according to the conventions of war, you can't shoot at us. And he's right. Now, the man in the ravine is a Frenchman. The rest are French Canadians. But his name is the Ensign Jumonville. And Jumonville did, in fact, march out of Fort Duquesne to deliver a letter to Washington in a very similar mission, mind you, that Washington undertook a year earlier in 1753. Again, reference Season 1, Episode 1 of Wartime to hear that story. But when it's all said and done, literally when the dust settles, Washington knows that though some Frenchmen were killed, though some Englishmen were wounded, there's really no harm, no foul, so long as the leader of the expedition is unharmed. And of course, that leader is the Ensign Jumonville, the man waving the letter frantically in the air, trying to stop the melee. Now, this point is critically important for us, because we have to understand that when you're dealing with the native societies, in Washington's eyes, in European eyes, one of the issues they have that separates them the most is their perceptions of the world. The natives come from a completely non-European, non-Western tradition. Their perceptions of all aspects of life are different. Most different amongst them, perhaps, is war. So when Washington and Tanich Harrison engage against the French, whenever it's clear to Washington that the brakes need to be hit, that we need to back off, that we may inadvertently start a war, those same sensibilities do not exist in the same way in Tanith Harrison's mind. And when those two lines cross, and when the confusion reigns, the aftermath is one of the grim and terrible examples of just how complex colonial America really is. Washington knows that if anything happens to Jumonville, he could inadvertently trigger a world war between Europe's two biggest empires. Not such a good day. So when he sees Jumonville still alive, he breathes a sigh of relief. The firefight ended. It could be written off as a mistake on both sides. These things happen all the time. And one of the issues Washington has is that when he approaches Jumonville, Jumonville speaks no English. Washington speaks no French. So a language barrier between two people who come from the same European tradition is a serious problem here in 1754. Well, what Jumonville is trying to tell Washington is that, again, he is a diplomat. The letter he's delivering is telling Washington and the English, more importantly, to vacate the Ohio country. That is French territory. But the message never gets across. So what occurs is, both men end up dealing with interpreters. And while that's going on, there's some downtime, the primary speakers are sort of off, distracted, doing their own things, and Tanith Harrison and his warriors strike. Tanith Harrison will grab Jumonville and throw him to the ground. And he'll begin asking him a whole host of rhetorical questions. He's not interrogating him, but he's making a statement. He says, "Are you an Englishman?" He knows he isn't. And then he grasps Jumonville by the collar. And he says in perfect French, "Tu n'es pas encore mort, mon père." Thou art not yet dead, my father. He pulls out a hatchet and splits the skull of the diplomat Jumonville in half. He pulls out Jumonville's brains, washes his hands in them, and makes a symbolic statement that any alliance or any recognition that the Iroquois Confederacy had with the Empire of New France is gone, and war is officially declared. Now, this is a gruesome scene. There's no question. And Washington, all of 22 years old, feeling pretty good about the situation before this, is ashen by the result. The one man who couldn't die was killed in extraordinarily gruesome fashion. And he doesn't understand what's happening. Washington panics. He begins shouting to the Half-King, "Why would you do that? How could you put us in such a bad situation?" But again, we can write it off to perhaps differing opinions on what the world looks like, depending on where you're from. So why did Tanith Harrison do this? I mean, it was a horrific scene. And by the way, from that point, that ravine, which you can still visit, basically intact, is still known as Jumonville Glen. Well, the reason Tanith Harrison did it was because of the differing perceptions of worldview. That's empire, and we talk about empire a lot in this series. For Tanith Harrison, representing the entire native perspective, the European ideal of signing ink on paper, forming diplomatic relations, holds no meaning. A name on paper is nothing. That's not a symbolic covenant. That's not a concrete example of their position. For Tanith Harrison, he needs something more tangible, and that's the Indian world. Again, most of the Indian world has no written language tradition. Tanith Harrison probably spoke upwards of 20 languages, so it has nothing to do with intelligence, but everything to do with perception. When Tanith Harrison murdered Jumonville, he did it on behalf of the Iroquois Confederacy. And Jumonville was literally a physical representation of New France. By murdering Jumonville and speaking to him in his own language, Tanith Harrison declared what we would think of as war against the Empire of New France. They were inciting a rebellion in Iroquois, and now Washington and the whole of the British Empire must deal with the aftermath. It was the end of May. What's going to proceed next is going to be about a month-long process, and it's going to involve some very deep and very subtle and very nuanced Indian diplomacy. We'll spend some time talking about that while setting up the larger events to come, in which we typically think put the British against the French. Now, after Jumonville's death, in late May of 1754, Washington understands a French retaliation out of Fort Duquesne is very likely to occur. Based on his intelligence, there are about 500 undermanned soldiers at the fort. That's more than enough to deal with Washington's 150, because remember, the reinforcements sent by Dinwiddie haven't yet arrived. Washington will retreat to an open clearing in the ocean of wilderness that was the Ohio country. And this open clearing, which is no more than 250 to 300 yards in any direction, was known by the locals as Great Meadows. It was a natural clearing in a world that didn't have them very often. So it was in this place that Washington decided by June 1st and June 2nd he would need to build a fort. And we use that term loosely. He needed to build something that could protect him, something quick, something fast, and something that could stop a bullet. That was really the level of sophistication he was faced with. They put together a small position. You could call it a strong house if you wanted. But it was about 60 feet across. It was circular. It was made of cut down trees. It was reinforced on the outside with bark and animal skins. And he called it, appropriately, Fort Necessity. It wasn't much. And the men building it knew that even though there was a smaller building on the inside for keeping supplies and ammunition dry, this fort wasn't going to stop much of anything. Washington was in a pinch. There's no question about it. And he was forced to make a very big decision. By about June 3rd, his position was well underway, and all he could do was await the return strike from the forces of France in Fort Duquesne. Now, in the meantime, Tanacharison had fled Washington's position, and his main goal was to speak to the various chiefs of the Ohio country. These are, again, the chiefs of the very people, the Delaware, the Shawnee, the Mingo, that the Empire of New France is trying to woo over to their side. Tanacharison doesn't know that within a year, these people will join New France in rebellion against the Iroquois. So this is one of his last efforts to get them to realign themselves in their traditional roles as subjects of the Iroquois in the Ohio country. Now again, the man he's going to approach is one of the highest ranking Delaware chieftains in the region. His name is Shingis, and Shingis has quite a reputation for his fiery temper and his aggressive foreign policy. He's got sort of a history as a rough and tumble fighter in his youth, and in his older age, he's a very stern but very decisive military leader. When Shingis makes a decision, he stays with it, and he lives up to his word. He'll meet with Tanacharison. Tanacharison will discuss his options with the other chiefs of the region, and unfortunately for him, there is no luck. There is no success. The overwhelming presence of New France is beginning to have its effect, and its desired effect, in swaying a lot of the major Ohioan leaders to their side. A few weeks after we see the debacle at Jumonville Glen, the Tanacharison, the Half-King, will return southward to meet with Washington at a place called Redstone Fort. Don't be deceived by the name. It's a minor outpost in this very wild and very open region known as the Ohio Country. When he's there, Tanacharison will unfortunately have to tell Washington there is nothing he can do. There is no support he can offer. And Shingis, although he wavered on his stance, was actually with Tanacharison at this meeting. And after they told the dejected Washington he was out of luck, Shingis said to him, and this is evidenced in Washington's journal, that he would assist him, but he couldn't do it in the way that Washington anticipated. This is a minor footnote in history that when you read it in the proper context, changes the entire story that will be the Battle of Fort Necessity. We'll fast forward now to July 3rd of 1754. And what we see is George Washington, his 100 regular Virginia militia, and about 150 to 200 support troops from New York, Maryland, North Carolina, and South Carolina in Great Meadows, surrounding their tiny fort in preparation for a French assault. Out of Fort Duquesne, days earlier, about 600 men, roughly 500 of them French, 100 of them Indian peoples from the Great Lakes region, have descended upon Washington's position and surrounded him on July 3rd. The sky is overcast. It's raining. Washington is clearly at a disadvantage. And the firefight begins at midday. Now, to give you some indication of how desperate Washington really is at Great Meadows in Fort Necessity, as he calls it, we can look at some extraneous examples that reveal much more than they initially seem. When you're using a musket of the 18th century, we all understand the loading process. It's very cumbersome. Powder, ball, ramrod, right? Put it down the shaft and hope to fire. Now, remember, that's going to fire if everything goes right. But in the event of a mistake, you have to undo all of that. And that means you have to get that musket ball out of that barrel. Well, the tool you use to do that is effectively a ramrod with a curly Q on the end. And you stick it down the shaft and you pull out the ball. We call this implement a worm. Now, Washington had about 300 men. In the middle of the rainstorm, they're surrounded by the French. They have three worms to work with. So if you want to know, are they undersupplied as well as undermanned? That should tell you everything you need to know to understand the setup to the Battle of Fort Necessity. The firefight will begin, and the French have a clear advantage from the beginning. Never mind the fact that they have almost, or maybe even more than, double the men Washington has. But understanding the layout of Great Meadows is just as important as anything else. Great Meadows is an open clearing, but it's surrounded by trees. And the trees are probably, from Washington's position, conservatively 100 yards. So, when you're looking at that, and sometimes it may be closer, at their closest, the French surrounding Fort Necessity were probably within 50 yards. From that vantage point, the French have two clear edges in this exchange. One, they have the cover of trees, and two, the manpower advantage. Now, the cover of trees may be the most important, because remember, it's raining all day. When powder is wet, it can't be fired. And Washington's men all have the same problem. Their gunpowder, when they do manage to shoot, is ruined by the rain. So many of them actually retreat into the fort and begin drinking. The end is near. That's the idea. But the French are staying dry because they're under these trees. And throughout the day, the fighting continues. Now, suddenly, in the middle of the night, when Washington and his men appear dead to rights, again, Washington is in a terrible state of depression. He hears a sudden voice from the forest. And it's French. And the French yells, "Vous parlez, parlez-vous." And what they're talking about is a negotiated surrender. Think of that. Washington is dead to rights. Yet the French are calling for a surrender. Why? Well, here's where it gets dicey. Because the French commander of that force was Louis Coulon de Villiers, and that is the older brother of the ensign Jumonville, who was killed, presumably by Washington, a month earlier. The commandant of Fort Duquesne assigned the Coulon de Villiers that position, so he knew that his quest for revenge to find the man who murdered his brother, George Washington, would see the mission through. There are many layers to this story. But here's a man clearly with a desire to gain some sort of retribution for his killed younger brother. Washington has almost no hope. Yet the Coulon de Villiers, the French commander, calls for a surrender. Now why? He could have finished Washington right then and there. But he calls for surrender. Well, this is where we get back to that one footnote we mentioned when it came time for Tanacharison, the Delaware chief Shingus, and Washington to meet before the battle. Remember, Shingus told Washington, "We can help you, but not in the way that you need." Washington thought they'd abandoned him. And that was the way the story went. Washington signs the surrender at Fort Necessity, and he survives and lives to fight another day. Lucky for us, right? Well, it's never that easy. Because remember, in history, when something seems too simple, when something seems like good fortune, it's probably just that you're not looking in the right way. So when we began reviewing the French journals of the Battle of Fort Necessity, something new emerged. Colon de Villiers, the leader, clearly an advantage, kept writing that over and over again, his Indian guides were telling him, "We hear English drums in the distance. We think reinforcements are coming." Now, clearly that wasn't the case. No one was coming to help Washington. But the Colon de Villiers' Indian guides kept telling him that. They were intentionally sabotaging the expedition by giving him bad intelligence. And in this way, when you consider that Shingus promised Washington that he would help, you see Shingus's promise come through. Washington will never know this in his life, but that's the power of history. So that's what we're faced with. The Ohioan Indians deliberately mislead the French to spare Washington in Great Meadows. It's a nice story, but why? Well, here's what we see. The Colon de Villiers has been bombarding Washington and Fort Necessity for hours, and he's running out of supplies. When he hears that English reinforcements are coming, he knows he can definitely beat Washington, but there is no way he can take on a reinforcing British force. So he calls for surrender. It's a very telling moment that shows just how much more of this story is revealed when you consider the Indian worldview. Why would Shingus, representing all the Ohioans who in the future will join with New France, make that decision? Well, at this point, it's all about balance. He can't see the future any more than we can. And in his mind, if only the French or only the British are left alone to reign over the Ohio country, who loses out? The natives. Because in that balancing act between those two powers, they are the ones who hold the cards. It's their affections that they all seek. George Washington can't speak French. The terms of surrender that he signs are unintelligible to him because they're written in French. So whenever he accepts the French surrender at Fort Necessity, he unknowingly signs his name to a document that says, in clear French, that he, George Washington, is responsible for the murder of the Ensign Jumonville, and he is an assassin. Washington signs it. He's got no other recourse. He doesn't know what it says. And that document will be spread all throughout New France and will very quickly become the talk of Paris itself, because you have on paper a British official signing that he willingly and knowingly assassinated a French military officer. If there is ever a cause for war, and believe me, between those two, it doesn't take much. That's it. So it's an amazing story. For Washington, he will say for the rest of his life, it is his most depressing and terrifying moment. He says for the rest of his time on this earth, he will never be able to celebrate that day because it's that depressing. What was the date? Well, the document was signed after midnight. It's July 4th, 1754. How meaningful, how poetic is the story when you consider what 4th of July still means to the American people. Now, this is the beginning of a much larger story. This sets in motion a series of events that will lead to what Winston Churchill will call the first truly world war, the Seven Years' War, in North America It's called the French and Indian War. It's the major conflict. It's the clash of empires. It brings Europe's two major powers together in a head-to-head conflict that will decide the future of North America forever. It's an incredible story. It's much more, though, than just a part of George Washington's life. It's a very telling and revealing moment in the history and future of British North America. Thank you for joining us again this week. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.